Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, world, and welcome to Realty Universal Radio, the fastest hour in radio, no doubt about it. I'm Randy Zachary, and this is a show about real estate, about God, about life, about giving back, about being the change in the world that you'd like to see. I'm privileged to bring to you Natalie Mullinex and Realty Universal, a company dedicated to excellence. Realty Universal is a revolution founded on a very simple principle. We believe sellers and buyers should have choices. We have been a pioneer in the menu program system. More on that, of course, a little later. Natalie Mullinex, president and founder of Realty Universal, averaged over $80 million a year in sales prior to stepping back to focus more on building Realty Universal membership network. She's an accomplished speaker, writer, consultant, trainer, and, oh, by the way, mother. She travels worldwide, literally, spreading the gospel, if you will, of Realty Universal. And now, Natalie Mullinex.
Hey, everybody. I'm so happy to be here another week, and so excited to do the show today. Hope everybody's well out there, and I know pretty much this time of year the weather is pretty good everywhere, not all over the earth, but most places. And real excited today. I'm in Hawaii today, and our guest is on the West Coast. We're probably not even going to have time for commercials this hour because it's going to fly by. We have so much to go over. And today we're going to be discussing zoning, permitting, community development, so many issues that apply for whether you're, when you own a home, if you're renting a home, if you're a builder, if you're in commercial real estate, it just applies to everybody. And it's really interesting the way our, you know, it's basically speaking in the U.S., but it applies everywhere. We kind of take for granted, and many of us don't realize how the infrastructure works. And we just kind of take for granted when we get in our cars or walk or, you know, go down the roads and the highways and have the lights and the amenities for us. And so today was going to be a really interesting show. I'm really privileged to be able to find out a lot of information and talk to our guest. So our guest is Jim Marquez. He, with over 40 years of experience in this industry, in zoning, permitting, planning. I mean, that's a lot of years and a lot of changes have taken place in that amount of time. Jim graduated from the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, in 1979 with a Master's in Governmental Economic Development, a BS in Urban and Regional Planning from the School of Planning and Environmental Design, California State Polytech University, in Pomona, California in 73 with an AS in Civil Engineering from East Los Angeles College in 1970. Whoa, that's a lot of training. And then in addition, first-hand training. The first 10 years, he was involved in professional growth in municipal planning to the position of Director of Planning and Redevelopment with the City of Hawthorne, California. One of his prominent assignments involved successful planning and implementation of a 1,000-acre commercial and industrial redevelopment plan amendment, which gave new insights to environmental design consternations in urban areas that predate the growth of the mid-40s and the aviation industry. Wow, I can't wait to hear about that. That's so without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jim Marquez.
Well, good morning, Natalie. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really excited to share what planning has done for me and how I look at the need for planning to be even more sustainable than we currently practice it.
Wow, that's and you, I mean, I'm so, this is such a pleasure. We like I was mentioning on your introduction, we probably won't be taking any commercial breaks since we only have an hour to go over. If anybody wants to call in, you can call in at 347-945-5428. But we can't take a lot of calls today. Of course, you can. We'll give contact information just because there's just so much to go over. We may open it up a little bit. Jim, your background is so interesting because you've got all the education. I mean, many times people, a lot of people in this business are in through, you know, growing through the thing. And you've actually, tell us a little about how you got started and how you, what your desire was for this, because you're really, like your whole career life has been in this industry.
Well, it started out with some education my father gave me. He was a civil engineer with the County of Los Angeles and worked for the state. So I grew up in a professional environment and understood that facilities had a real place in how we develop our urban areas, and things need to be developed in underdeveloped areas. And my curiosity was probably my biggest guiding instrument for me. I started out in civil. I learned a lot of the big basics, and then I went to Cal Poly, where I think their motto is just incredible. Their motto is learn by doing, which is pretty much the way most real estate professionals execute their careers.
Yes.
Learn a bunch of, you know, things.
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely.
Divesting of trusts and complications and title, and that breadth of, or that outline of things that were all connected became my big curiosity. And I started understanding it one project at a time, pretty much like everybody else. And the strongest basis, I thought, was what are the rules in government? What are they telling us? What do our state legislators advocate for and legislate for subdivisions and real estate rules under the departments of real estate throughout the country? Pretty much everything I learned, everything is generally the same. There's purposes for these codes. Understanding that when you're dealing with a complex situation can sometimes really focus your solution. Let's give you an example. You have a subdivision. It's about ready to expire, and everybody's nervous. The map, that you haven't gotten a letter from the county or so telling you that you have no more time to extend, and I'm sorry.
So you're in the middle of doing a subdivision? Okay.
Sure. And yet, if you filed everything, there's sections of the code that if you read through them, they'll tell you the government is really there to process your work and help you get your subdivision. And if some time frames take place and expire, there's a blessing in the code. If the county has them, they have the permission to just continue on, and there's no loss on the subdivider's part. Obscure, maybe, kind of outside on the left wing.
Right.
Codes are there all to protect us from health, safety, and really keeping our economic prospects in the direction we're intending them to be.
Because we've got so much to cover today too. When a lot of people don't take for granted, okay, that when they go out and you know you see your communities and you have the residential and your commercial and your, you know, say industrial areas. A lot of people take for granted because the houses are usually in one cluster, and then we have beautiful parks and green areas, or depending on where you are. Of course, in the cities, they still even have things laid out. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, how that started? Is it just common sense from years ago? Do they, you know, when they first got the ideas? Because I know now they have actual master plans, and master plans can be years old. You know, they plan out the future. So can you tell us a little bit about, just so people understand, hey, you know, the things we take for granted are actually part of this big plan. Can you tell us how that kind of started and how that lays out a little bit?
Well, you know, in our urban society in today's date, now, currently, we really take a lot of that background, settlement background, let's give it a name like that, where cities started, where the routes for transportation are. Those came about historic over time. And historically, we found that they're convenient for us. I've read that many times roadways, original major arterial roadways, were formed on paths that animals took, migratory.
Really?
Animals.
So they kind of paved the way for us?
Yeah, they do.
Really?
They take the shortest route. There was a professor out of the University of Oregon, I think his name was Halperin, I could be wrong. Anyway, he did something called the Oregon Experiment, where he put food at the entrances to the different college buildings, science, engineering, health, and the animals walked to to eat the food, and that's where then he laid out his concrete pathways, and students didn't bisect the grass areas, the landscape areas anymore.
Wow, so, what a great idea. That's an interesting, wow.
So these two things are really focusing on something. They're focusing on, we look at the environment first. You know, people have put the houses down at the bottom, and then a 100-year storm comes and wipes them all out. Today, most of that is all behind us. We don't have some improper areas. But, you know, there are a few that come to mind, and that would be some of these areas where the industries are changing, the auto industry or steel manufacturing, and those areas are just perfect for re-gentrification to new, more healthy land use settlements.
Really? Like Detroit?
Yeah, possibly. And here's the scary one. Maybe some areas should be looked at and say, you know, why don't we pick up and go somewhere else? Because we don't have enough water here, or there's too much air pollution, or there's some contaminant in the groundwater supply from some improper operations in the 1900s, you know. You don't know. And so instead of saying fight our environment and putting people where they might be in an unhealthy situation, planners are trying to look at this and try to explore where these old settlements have worked, where they don't work, and where they might be better served.
Well, what about you have, like, what comes to mind when you're saying this, I think of like New Orleans, you know, and with the levees and how the water level's so low, and the people go back in and they rebuild and they go back in again. They want to go home. I think about, like, in Malibu, you know how many fires they have constantly, and, you know, the fires or the brush fires, and then, or the homes go away, and then people just rebuild. So it just brings that to mind, you know, that sometimes people still want to go back in these areas.
The last time I was on the Big Island, I was driven around to the East Coast, and I got to see where the hot lava is going into the ocean, and I was informed that there was a settlement there that had been annihilated by the molten lava, and they rebuilt it.
Yeah, they have like lava zones, and you'll have people build in lava one, which is hard to believe they would want to, because if it comes, it's definitely going to come through. You know, the odds are in your favor that if you're in lava zone one and it erupts, it's going to come through. You just never know exactly which house it's going to hit. But you're right. So that's pretty interesting.
So what happens with these environmental perspectives on your geography? They lead into how do we lay out the land so that one use isn't gobbling up another, and one is more protected and safe, and where the parks are so the kids can walk from their home easily to school and to parks and to, you know, convenient shopping and all that. And that's where zoning comes in, where they take the geography of the land and they start to segment where people drive through, and then they start to identify where the settlement should be and work within normal distances or some physical, serious construction on how far people have to go do what they're going to do in these different districts. And it's mindfully protective so that one use doesn't create a nuisance or activity that would be uncomplimentary to its neighbors, so to speak.
That makes sense. So like, for example, Nevada, I know Las Vegas, Nevada, we have an office there, and I know there's concern about, well, water, and then water's pulled off the Colorado River, and then also the pollution from the cars because of, you know, and so there are some concerns there because it's growing so fast. So that would be something that you all would look at too, right, with the zoning and environmental issues. Would you tie that in?
Well, you know, it comes into focus in two separate but connected agencies. The local agency relies on what they would call, say, the water agency for the district, okay? And when a development is going to take place, they ask the developer to go check with those districts to see if they have enough, depending on the size of the development, say it's a small community Maybe it's a large one with maybe 1,000 houses they're going to put in support for commercial and roads and stuff. So it's pretty big.
Okay.
They'd have that large project do an academic investigation engineering-wise to identify what the demand would be if this new use was in full operation and what the service capacity is of this district that would provide this water. And now that we are in a drought-tolerant situation, we're in water conservation mode throughout the country, mm-hmm. but really serious here in California, they also have to identify the cost savings, not the cost savings, but the water savings consideration this development is coming up with to be able to more correctly show what the real demand on that system is. So that the project can look as good as best possible, you know, and try to become
right.
sustainable in this kind of situation.
I want to. I want to go. Now I'm going over some broad questions for you because then we're going to dig into
yes.
the you know individual you know the specific zoning issues. What do you think about like our infrastructure across the country of the United States? You know, with the railroads, the highways, things that were built over 100 years ago, you know, type of situation I would imagine that's something that you've come across or in your, you know, your colleagues and you have spoken about at some point, I would think. What's going to happen? How is it going to get fixed? Is it just incrementally, city by city, town by town? Because we're coming on some really old areas from what I've heard over the years. Old infrastructure.
Sure. We just heard about a pipeline recently, right, in our news last week that had aging problems and broke, caused a big environmental disaster. But in our government, our transportation, Department of Transportation at the federal level, over the many, many years ago, initiated a program to fortify, I'm going to say, our rail line system. Back in the 70s, they issued many, many permits and promoted railroad companies to separate grades, raise the rail line so that impeding flooding in areas would not slow down cargo. That took quite a number of years to implement. And since then, I understand that our rail industry has been mindfully maintained and quite successful as it grows. I think
Wow.
the pipeline issue, on the other hand, is something that because I don't know what is going on with it, but that's a real serious item because when we have earth shaking and there's earthquakes all around the world, California is not the mm-hmm. only one whose ground shakes, those piping
right.
connections fatigue and they are spending a lot of time and attention trying to identify where these weaknesses are. And I think as a planner, we are asked when a project is going to be proposed to do an investigation if you have underground supply petroleum pipelines under your land. Down here in Southern California from Long Beach, we receive pipelines from the ocean to the city. In many communities down here, we have high-pressure gas and oil pipelines coming up from Texas. So they travel from state to state within states. And if they're flowing and they're always operational, those are probably the safest. It's the ones that are neglected or they stop and then corrosion starts to take place because of moisture on the inside and the metal will start to decompose. And
wow.
I don't know that much about the metallurgy. I think there would be another show probably for you to do, but it's a real concern because they're trying to do things now like inject plastic into some of these pipes that show signs of future fatigue so that they don't have to uproot them to save money. And the types of
plastic. That wouldn't be good environmentally, though, would it? The plastic wouldn't be good, I would think, unless it's biodegradable. Huh?
There you go. I don't know. You know, we're talking about things they're trying, and I don't know what the oversight for those
yeah.
kinds of considerations
I just
are.
Hope
but
they,
you're right. One point.
No, I hope they really think of the environment more than just the money. I don't mean to sound like that, but I just get frustrated when they try to cut the corners, you know. But Wow.
Yeah.
That's our, so now we're going to, I'm going to go over that. That is such, it's just amazing. It's just, so in the community now, tell us where are you in California? Because you've spent years in the zoning there. So now we're going to zone in on your location, because what I've noticed from being in the industry for 30 years, and I've been involved in a lot of Raleigh and record plat deals with, you know, different developments, new home developments, is, you know, even though there's differences in different cities and counties, anybody listening in now, it's pretty much in the U.S., they follow along a lot of the same format, you know, the outlines, and then you just have to find out what the different zoning codes are and where to go, et cetera. So let's dig in on your where you are. Okay.
Okay. I've spent the majority of my government career working in cities, small cities and large cities in urban Southern California. And those agencies follow the same state zoning regulations that all of our cities and counties follow. And those zoning regulations prescribe several things that help us understand our real estate. They identify, they give you a label for your property, say it's single-family residential, and you can look in the code and identify the types of uses that are permitted. They specify where you can put the house on the land, how large the lot needs to be, what kind of orientation it should have to the street so you can get into it and get out easily. And when you pull a permit, you have to make sure that everything you build on the property conforms to those aspects. But say, for example, your house has a big backyard that starts to slope down, say, towards the middle, from the middle of the lot backwards. So you really can't, you don't have a backyard. You can't, kids can't go out there and play. You can have a deck, but you really aren't supposed to build a deck in that direction because there's a setback. There's a restricted building area. Mm. You look around, your neighbors all have backyards. That's a perfect example of how you can ask the city, wait a minute, we have a hardship with our land, the shape of the lot, the way the ground flows in the back. I can't use it. Would you give me permission to put a deck out there, even though it's in that restricted buildable area, so that now my kids have a place they can play? And that's exactly the
excellent
way the thinking behind a code works. They're trying to help you balance out what they want everybody to enjoy.
Excellent. So what would they, if you know you own a house like that, then they go in and where do they go? What do they do? What's your first step?
Good point. They go into the same office you go into when you're doing a listing and you want to make sure you're telling the buyers that this property can do certain things. It's the zoning department. And they will answer your questions and, in a sense, spoon feed you the restrictions and information you should know and are asking about so that you can make adjustment in this case, file the variance, they give you the forms, they tell you to put together certain exhibits, and you oftentimes have to go to an architect or an engineer because in some cases they want you to, like the water, the flooding, they want to prove that you're not going to be in harm's way, whether it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether your project's going to have too much traffic. I'm going from little to big, I'm sorry.
No, it's wonderful. It's great. No,
yeah.
It's wonderful.
That's how they work. Yeah. That's how planners put everything together.
And then they're going to have to get them, tell us they're going to have to get permits. Now, would that fall under variances as well? Because it's an area that's not supposed to be built? Or?
Yes, it would. And there's a number of applications that the agencies have. And it's just not limited to, say, cities. The Bureau of Land Management, which is federal lands. There are state lands, state tied land, just land in general, all has restrictions and uses for that land. And when you have, say, a reason to run, say, a roadway in sensitive lands that may belong to the state, you go to that agency and they have an application process. Some fees can be excessive. Sometimes you have to do a complete assessment on impact that request you want to make could possibly have on the environment, and it takes the submittal of a lot of documentation to show how this project impacts this area.
Well, you know, we're going into like a, wow, okay.
Yeah, and in the simple case where you're doing a variance, you're showing them how you're being denied a right others are using. That analysis is simple. They can use their backyard. Your deck is encroaching in the wrong space, but you're making the property owner whole. That's the limit. They don't go any further than that. The large project where you're going to create impact on sensitive habitat or water systems or underground water supply, everyone now who's interested in development is involved with serious economic and engineering analysis.
That's really good though, because I know, like, for example, in Maryland, if somebody wants to do a builder, wants to do a development, of course, the zoning code will tell you how many homes per acre or per lot that you can build. Sometimes builders try to get a higher density and put townhomes in or condos or single-family homes. But it's interesting, is it the same in California where the builders are basically kind of, they have to, all that infrastructure has to be there, and then they have to be responsible for putting in the curbs and the gutters and the driveways, et cetera, right? Is that the same way in California? They have to do.
Yes, it is. I had a client who picked up a property up in the Santa Clarita area of Los Angeles County, and he was following all of the regulations of the county, and with the number of homes he was going to put in, they required a second large street access so that those people could get out in the event of an emergency from two major directions, and he had to build a bridge over Santa Cruz, over a creek out there by Sand Canyon, and that's how far the protection review process of government helps us. Our communities today, they're becoming more sustainable, but their livability is, and enhanced livability is what the intention of these processes of filing an application, having your plans and engineering reviewed, and then we hadn't talked about this, and that is there's a public hearing where they write a report, somebody takes an objective review and look at your development intentions, and then it makes a contrast between what the codes say, what the community is like in the physical sense, and what impacts you may be creating on engineering services or the geography or the air, noise, whatever. And then you have a hearing, you make your presentation, you answer questions, if they challenge you and they tell you this is bad and you shouldn't do this, you may make concessions like, let's go back to your Maryland example, where the developer has a very large piece of land and he has an interest to have a few more homes. Well, if his professionals go back to the code and find out from the city, why is it that they only allow one house for every acre of land when we all know pasture land, agriculture land could really sustain a lot more? And then make plausible argument that you're not disrupting things. You're not going to be putting a lot more cars on the local roadways to create adversity. You're not going to have so many homes that you're going to ruin the underground water supply. So you start talking in terms that can show that you may want to go and grab more apples out of off the tree, but you're not going to be hurting anything. And does the community like it? You have that full spectrum of consideration, review, public exposure, transparency, and then a decision gets to be made. And they can change the zone. They can change the densities and give you what may be a new direction. They may never thought that a community would grow out that far when they first planned themselves.
Then the community gets to have their say, so all the neighbors get to come to the meeting and people get to chime in and be a part of the whole process. And then at some point, it sounds
And it becomes very wholesome when you've been to small community meetings, I'm sure, where you have a zoning matter that's affecting a piece of property that you're transferring, and you sit there and you watch the dynamics, and you start to get a feeling and a sense for what are the things the community is most concerned about with applications like yours? And you then accept the conditions, or you may say to them, well, you know, our condominium project is going to be next to these single-family homes. We're allowed to do it, but our bathroom windows are going to be put up against the ceiling so that no one will look down and see it in the property. And the neighbors next door, yeah, okay, you know. So you make concessions. As simple and minded as that one may be, it's a good example of how you can take a physical aspect like a development and adjust it so you can show that you're trying to be a good neighbor.
That's really good. I've seen developers, you know, give part of the land to schools, communities, different things. You know, we have an issue right now in Maryland on a small development where they're going to need to obtain an easement from a church for the sewer, because the sewer lines go where the state road is. It's been kind of, it's zigzagged a little bit, and they're going to need just a little bit of an area where they're going to need somebody else's property to go through. Really amazing when you get into the details of how this all works and the infrastructure and how it affects everybody. I love it. I love it how these the different departments are set up. And so if somebody's a homeowner and they want to go in and say they want to see if they can make money off of their property by pulling off one lot, what do you suggest they go to the permit department first, the zoning, or I would think before they actually hire an architect, or not an architect, a planner, engineer? What would you suggest?
No, that's exactly what they should do. And they should go in there open and say, you know, I have this property like this, and ask them, what are the methods that I could employ to accomplish my mission? You know, be open. And because, like, sometimes you'll hear, well, you've got to change this, you've got to change that, and the fees might, in California, fees for permits are high, and in other areas, they're very low. So it's usually not the money side of it. What it is can you accomplish it? And by being straightforward, they will look at your property in a serious way and say, well, all of your buildings should have permits, and what you want to do will need to follow these kinds of rules. And if you can't, these are the types of exceptions you're allowed. And these are the things we don't want you to do because they create adversity. You know,
So if somebody wants to divide, like say they have an acre and the zoning lets them build two houses on the acre and they only have one, they could theoretically pull off one half an acre and maybe sell that, make a profit, pay off their existing mortgage, right? And I'm just giving an example. And then that's one thing they could maybe to get value out of their land. But they need to be allowed because some places – you know, they may not have. It's interesting where people need to see the codes, right, to see how much you can divide a lot. Because, for example, I'm in Hawaii. In Hawaii, oh, gosh, the smallest lot can still be divided compared to what I've seen on the mainland. Usually you need, it just depends where you are. No, it's like they're not making any more land, you know, so they kind of get every piece of it. So, well, tell us that, I know this is great because we're covering whether you're a builder or as a homeowner or permits. When we get into that issue, everything needs to be permitted, right? But a lot of times, can you tell us? Like sometimes people say, "I didn't want to permit that because I don't want my taxes going up." I didn't, you know. And then with selling it becomes a problem because we have to disclose. Lots of times, the lender's not going to count it. The appraisers don't want to count unpermitted areas in an appraisal. So, what's your thoughts about permits? And I'm not holding you to it. I don't want you, you know, because I know you have to tell everybody you must be permitted. But your general thoughts on permits.
Well, let's go back to what the ordinances actually label unpermitted buildings to be. On one hand, they call them non-conforming buildings because they don't necessarily have the zoning permission to have been built and the building permit after that. And they classify some of them legal and some of them illegal. For example, a building that was built in, say, 1900, and it's an old craftsman with a barn and a whole bunch of stables and even a machine shop in the back. Well, when the city incorporated back in 1923, they accepted anything that was built as being legal. So even though it doesn't have a permit, it's not even connected to the sewer. You don't know how it got wire pipe, you know, telephone lines and all that put to it, but it's legal. They accept it the way it is. If they make the code, will then say, well, we'll keep it that way. You're fine. That's your bundle of rights. Get value out of it. You can even loan against it and insure it. But if you change it, you're going to have to come in and get new permits and conform to 2015 codes, not the codes that didn't exist in 1900. So they protect the new. They allow you to keep your old. There was another point I was going to make with this, and that was when you have a building that is not permitted. It never received a permit. You added a bungalow out to the back of your garage, and your daughter lived there while she was going to college, and now she's gone, and you want to re-rent it. And that one tenant doesn't want to pay the rent, so he calls up the city and says, my landlord has an illegal building. He's got me back in here, and the sewer leaks. Well, he's complaining because he doesn't have any money, and he wants you to fix it. Now the property owner is in trouble, and he has to go through the process of working with engineers, architects, himself if he wants, and legalize the permit or remove it. And sometimes to remove it, he's stuck because he's getting rent out of it, and he's upside down now. And that becomes a pretty difficult scenario, and it's different in every community, and it's different because every situation has health and safety issues that the building department under the state that they're operating in is required to protect the occupant. So that's another subject all by itself, probably, or show.
So on the permits, do you think it definitely behooves somebody to always get the permits, and for many reasons, right?
Yeah, I advocate it even for properties I buy that may have components that are non-conforming and illegal. You know, I make the assessment. Yeah, some things are unsafe, and fortunately I've been around enough where I can look at them and kind of see what might be safe and what might be unsafe to continue. And I make a value judgment at that time. But you're right.
Well,
no,
you know what? But I have a question before I forget it, because when you were talking about the permits and everything, and you were talking about the older building that may be non-conforming, okay, because it was under the old zoning, which it still can stay usually. I mean, everybody has to check if, as long as they're not doing something different or making changes, right? So when you were saying that, it made me think about historic buildings. So, for example, some states call a building historic after 50 years. Some say 100 years. So it really can vary wherever you are. That's the kind of like the same. You could be on the historic register and not allowed to make changes as well, right? How does that apply with the permit?
It's interesting. I was sitting on a historic preservation board over here in Wilmington for a number of years, and the over by Banning Museum, really nice, lovely, lovely sub area of Los Angeles, and our rules for operating. Follow the historic preservation guidelines of the at the federal level, and you can. They're not telling you can't do things to the building. They're not even telling you can't add a modern addition onto the building. What they're telling you is you have to be careful and critical when we want to add to the exterior of this building to keep it harmonious. You can keep the same styling. You go back to the original coloring of paint that they used back then. You try to avoid bringing in landscape materials and yard settings that would be contradictory to the theme that was going on at that point. So they can keep a historic district. That's why they require you to follow a historic application process. Whittier's like that. There's a lot of areas of Los Angeles that have historic preservation areas. No wonder.
Is it 50 years there, or is it older? Do you know? Because I know Maryland's like 100 years. It depends on.
I believe it's 50. You're allowed to do it if the house or the building is at least 50 years of age. I think that's the way the guidelines are. Yeah.
Okay. That, you know what? We haven't taken one break, and we only have about 20 minutes left. We've really gone over. So, you know, what I realized is I want to give your contact information because people, okay. when they listen to the show, they know they can go email radio@realityuniversal.com. They can also go on our website, and we're going to forward it. But let's give it now. If you want to go ahead and give us your contact information, that would be great.
Sure,
I'm sure people are going to have questions.
All right, I'm International Zoning Doctor. It's
dot
too
com.
Much to say. dot com, yes. And my email address is my name, jimmarquez@att.net.
Okay. Is it okay to give a phone number, or would you prefer somebody just email or go to the website?
Well, I can give you my number. I'm 310-748-8726.
Great.
I thought of something that comes to mind. There are people that I know that I've worked for in the past, and what I get are interesting phone calls from them saying, I'm interested in doing this on this land. Can I? And I then go out and do some investigation to show them what these different codes say. And I had one highest and best use study just a few months ago from a family who had inherited their parents' business selling religious supplies. And their property is right downtown L.A. in a non-conforming residential zone, and they have a commercial business on it. And they want to know
wow.
that they can. Yeah, and it's been there for ages. I don't remember how many years, but it's probably non-conforming also. And I gave them a litany of opportunities that they could have, including modifications they could make or variances and zone changes and plan amendments they could ask for to be like the high-rise buildings across the street.
Wow.
So
there's so much. You really know what you know.
Well, that's the point. You don't know until you look at the land, and there's a process of looking at all these things, so it's not rocket science. But it needs to be done in every case. Another simple one, I had a piece of property out in Riverside County, obscure desert area. No one could see any clearness to what real value you could get out of it. And I said to them, well, look it, I was looking at the code, and it says all of the uses listed under here, which are like nurseries and parts places, little commercial property. But it also says in here, folks, please refer to the uses that are found in the chapter ahead, in front of this one, the lower.
Mm.
And in there, there was a permission for a motel. And it wasn't listed.
Really?
Yeah, but
wow.
you could have everything that you had in the first zone could be had in the less restrictive zone, the second zone over, like it was C1, then C2, then commercial manufacturing. And every one of those headings said you could have any use permitted in the prior. So I got to show these people that they weren't valueless. They didn't just have a lot with a bunch of weeds and rocks on it. They had permissions that were provided to them in the code that they weren't even aware of.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's.
What type of
definitely.
Clients that come to you too late are people who go in to a city, they buy a piece of property, they want to open a flower shop, and they go into the business license, they file their permit to occupy, they're fine. They go up to planning to get a building department to get a permit to put their new Flowers R Us sign. They can't get a permit because they got to go to planning. It takes them 3 months to get a conditional use permit approved.
Mm.
They got to go to an architect to design the sign copy or the sign company and file the application and go through. And they have 3 months of only grand opening and a vinyl banner that's hanging above the building, and it doesn't have the presence they wanted to have. So
that's horrible. It's so important to know.
Yeah.
It's so important to do a feasibility study in your contracts and make sure that you before you buy a property or you're going to get in, that you've checked all these things out ahead of time. And then if you're going to need definite permits that aren't there, if you're going to have a business, you kind of need to wait until that's approved before closing even, I would think. That's definitely after the fact, isn't it, what you're talking about? Boy, that's not a good situation to be in.
No. In the urban area, there's a lot of stirring around now. People are starting to build more now that our economy is, lightening up, getting a little healthier. But the type and class of development they're doing is a little different than we had in the past. They are, like the Maryland case, trying to intensify, but they're required to do some, I think, mindfully sustainable approaches to protect our watershed. They collect the water from the roof, and they're in drums and some sort of catchment underground device, and then they take it out of that reservoir and use it on the grounds to reduce the amount of water they need. Too bad we're such a desert climatology here, otherwise there would be more rainwater that they could use, but at least when we get it, they're able to do that. And it's important for other considerations to take place. I see more people wanting to be completely off the grid and not put their solar panels into the local distribution system. I think Hawaii's a leader in that, so to speak. People have chosen for quite a while now to just have their own power. And in some municipalities, they have a restriction and they require to be tied up.
I've seen areas where they have moratoriums on that, and it's not right. I mean, I think citizens need to fight those moratoriums because they should be able to have it, I believe. They definitely should. Interesting. I know on Oahu they had them and they released it now, where they had some moratoriums on being able to. Well, a lot of the electric companies still have converters you have to pay for, but that could be only $17 a month, for an example. So, and the citizens really, this what you're talking about is so awesome, and I think citizens, homeowners, everybody, it really behooves everyone to become aware of what's going on in your community. So that you know. So where would you suggest if somebody wants to stay updated in their community of these changes, these zoning changes and other things that can affect them, where would they go to stay updated? I mean, pretty much, because every community has their chamber of commerce, but what would you suggest?
Well, staying up with the Planning Commission, maybe writing a letter to the local agency and ask to be sent notices of public hearing that pertain to certain things either the city clerk or the planning department for planning matters, city clerk for overall city matters. If you're concerned about, say, the dam breaking you're building a big transportation system, you may want to be connecting with the public works department that handles that. There's a division in the city for every aspect that takes place, a water department, airport department, general administration for all the staff. And planning is a great department, because linking department. They will tell you which agency or division to go to and in what order, which is a big thing,
Wow, this has been great. This has been wonderful. Well, and the master plan, how hard is it to look at a master plan? Will they just give you a master plan of the entire community or what? Does that include everything?
We don't have a lot of time. Yeah, master planning is big because of the work that they go through, to all the studies and everything they do and research to create the plan. And once they do, they try to give you the information in a real simple, straightforward way. The map itself is the general idea of what they think should be laid out, the way the entire jurisdiction should be laid out. And then you focus in directly on where you are, and you look at it in the context of, kind of like a bubble around you. What kind of influences would be there? And then you then identify what they tell you you can do in that district. For example, if it's a dark residential, it means it's high density, and then they tell you that that corresponds with a few zones that you could build under, and then you can decide how intense you want your development to be. So that's the way you use a general plan. It's giving you the basic direction you could take to build it out, build your land out to the maximum.
Well,
and
this
if it's
has been
going
very,
in the direction,
very...
then... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, this has been so enlightening. It's just been really, there's so many different things to look at, you know, so many areas of what consists of your community, you know, what and the, like you said, the water, the environmental, the building, the codes, there's just so much data to check into.
And for me, it's pretty exciting because all these dynamics are moving on at the same time. They're all in motion. You know, the environment's always changing. Someone's going to come in and ask for a new telecommunication permit on a building that the neighbors don't want to see you ruin.
I was just going to ask you that about telecommunications. I know we're just about running out of time. How does that work with the telecommunications, and does that tie in with the cell phone towers too, or is it just different? Everything everybody needs is the internet and phones, et cetera, or what?
Well, in about the 10 years I spent doing a lot of telecom for all the carriers, even going to New Mexico for Sprint, I learned that there's another company involved, and that is the tower companies. So you have these companies that have towers 250 or whatever height they are, and there's one on the top of a mountain in Colorado and another one in Kansas, and they transmit signals all across our country and the world. And then you have all the small sites that are for our phones pretty much. And in some communities, they want them – they're spaced out geographically on a grid because they are if they're any further apart, they wouldn't be able to catch a signal. So the radio frequency engineers for the companies have created grids that allow the transmission to take place through the air. But if you block it, if there's a big building that comes up and is interrupting the way that is flowing, you get garbled up. And these companies are always asking the cities, don't make your height or, in certain cases, your height restriction paramount, because we're trying to avoid imperfections with other parts of the geography. You know,
wow.
Yeah, and then
there's so much, you know. Then we get into electric magnetic fields and the damage that's happening. Oh, that's a whole nother show. That's like a whole nother topic altogether. With the
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's so amazing. It's so interesting.
So where are things going now? I think whenever we build, we're going to be collecting our rainwater. We're going to be careful with what kind of fixtures and appliances we use, so they don't demand too much of our utilities, and I think the livability of the interior of businesses and homes are going to become much more comfortable and less complicated than they've been in the past. We're not going to have, say, a formal dining room. We're just going to have a large kitchen, living room, play area arrangement for our homes and furnish it in little settings so that it works and still makes us feel like the olden days. But everybody is open. There's better air quality. You have less demand in your heating and air conditioning system because everything is one large space. And the insulation for the buildings and the way the volume of the space can be put together becomes more enjoyable. And the homes are going to be smaller. Everybody is moving.
You think they're going to be smaller?
There's reasons for people to build the big mansion. You know, that's their culmination. But I think for the normal guy, the retired couple that are going to go live someplace else now that they finish their career in Des Moines, Iowa, and now they're going to go to Florida or something and retire, they're going to go to something that
smaller.
Fits them.
There's a book written by
a professor out of Berkeley, Christopher Alexander, has written a book, and he talked about theories or considerations for how you put things together. He talked about a home for old people. It has to be small, he'd say. But you better have two little areas so they don't always have to be in each other's space.
I like that. We did a show on those tiny houses before. We're running out of time right now, but I don't know how people can live in this 150 square foot, but I guess you can, you know, you can do it. You can do it. Definitely do it. It's That's interesting. That's really, wow. So really all this experience is paying off in for our communities, right? It's really the groundwork and the framework that's been put in place all these years is actually just going to make it better and better, which is wonderful. You are just a wealth of information. I want to say again, it's Jim Marquez, and Jim's website is internationalzoningdoctor.com. Jim's email is JimMarquez at att.net, JimMarquez@att.net, and his phone number is 310-748-8726. We've got about 4 minutes left, so I'm just going to let you let the listeners say what you want to put out there as a parting shot, and just finish up on some of the items we went over.
Well, I think with
so I'm going to turn
like
it over
that,
to you.
I think the first thing I should say to everybody is I'm here for business. I'd love to help you with your land use matters. For people who are inheriting property, one of the best things you can do is have a highest and best use study performed for your real estate that you're taking over before you guys decide how you want to split it up. If there's your paperwork identifies how you want to split it up, take a look and see how the zoning regulations allow you to divide land. And how you can take that and trade it to another property that could give you a different paradigm for financial holdings, real estate holdings. If you want to divide land, whether it's to create two lots or you want to create a condominium complex or more lots, you have to think about the length of time that process is going to take before you can build on your land and be able to sell the land. It could take, in some agencies, a couple years. And you have to do all of the engineering and all of the identification of how the property is going to connect to the utilities up front before you can start selling off the land. When you want to change your zoning or get a variance, you're going to have a time frame for submittal, you're going to have a time frame before a hearing, and then they're going to give you a decision and you can have a period of time to build. So I think planning is really a responsibility for knowing what you want to do and the different approaches you can take to get there, and then program it out so that you can afford it for one, but you can afford the time is the real big deal. There's never a dull moment in city planning, never a dull moment. Every property is different, and everything's always changing.
I love it.
Couldn't be better.
I love it. We will definitely have to have you back, and we'll definitely recommend you. And I hope I can call you, too, when I have questions. We have so many different types of situations that do come up. That's really... So it's all in planning, isn't it? Just everything is so important. You get the idea in your head what you want to do. And the other thing I took away from to our show today is that how you said don't just assume because your zoning says this, maybe you can get a variance. Don't just assume because the rules say no, we can't do this. Check into it and see if there's a way to work around it, right? Bring your ideas. Plans. Don't always just think that, well, it's a rule, it's too bad, forget it. I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that. Doesn't hurt to ask, doesn't hurt to check it out. Not at all.
Yes. That's true.
Absolutely. Well, we would love to have you back, and this has been enlightening, and to all our listeners out there. So one parting shot, because we've got about 1 minute, and then we're going to sign off.
Well, we have three aspects to city planning. One, what the character looks like and what you want to do. The professionals, you need to have their hands to help you because their licenses are required. There isn't a project today that can be finaled off when it's commercial, industrial, and there's a landscaping plan. The state of California says that all landscape plans have to be signed by a California licensed landscape architect. And if you have a condition like that, that means you've got to go down and get one of those guys to sign off on your plan. They want
awesome.
To make sure
Fantastic.
That our plant
yep.
arrangements are protecting our water. Water conservation is the umbrella we're all holding.
God, this is wonderful. Thank you. Oh, we're going to go. Okay.
Oh, thank
so we're
going to
go. Thank you very, very much. We want to have you back, and that it's definitely do not try to do that yourself. Is base and to everybody out there, I wish you peace.
Thank you for joining us on Realty Universal Radio. Our hope is that you are enlightened, encouraged, and mobilized to be an agent of change. Realty Universal is on Facebook. Join us there. Follow us also on Twitter at Realty Universal. And for more information, you can go to RealtyUniversal.com. Make it a great day.